From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Electoral College has its supporters, it has its critics, but most everyone agrees it doesn't work the way it was designed to work by the country's first leaders. The founders didn't like the idea of letting people vote directly for president. They thought politicians would manipulate the simple folk and you'd end up with a demagogue. The Electoral College was supposed to be a representative group of people who deliberate and render a decision, but there's not a whole lot of deliberating going on in the Electoral College these days, whatever that is even anymore. Some say, ditch it. We've matured as a country, we can handle the responsibility and the logistics. Others say there'd be chaos if you did that. It could radicalize the country, that rural Americans would be neglected and forgotten. So today in the program, a conversation about the Electoral College. You knew this was coming after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The debate about the Electoral College has started up again for the obvious reasons. Then this reason in particular, in one of the most rancorous presidential elections in recent history, the candidate who is today the president-elect received 1,339,019 fewer votes. But of course, that's the way it works. It's happened before. Everyone knew the rules going in. Everyone campaigned accordingly. And like it or not, the Electoral College is part of our history. It's written into the Constitution. Still, people are asking again, maybe it's time to ditch it. Maybe it had a purpose. The founders were nervous about a popularly elected president. We get it. But surely now we can manage the responsibility and the logistics. And can we? That's what the show is about today. We're going to first hear from Professor Gary L. Gregg. He's a presidential scholar. He directs the McConnell Center for Political Leadership at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. And Gregg supports the Electoral College, even though he admits it doesn't work like it was designed to work. He worries about the mechanics of getting rid of it. But as he told us when we talked to him earlier this morning, one of his biggest concerns is that reforming the electoral process, the Electoral College, could change or distort the nature of American democracy.
Yeah, I think the stakes are very high. You know, I'm not one that looks at democracy and what we have as a automatic or a simplistic kind of thing. I guess I'm a student of Alexis de Tocqueville, who came to America in the 1830s, looked at America and wrote admiringly about America and all of the things that go into making America work as a democracy. And so I don't take any change lightly, and particularly change as fundamental, that change that really shapes lots of our political system, I would argue, at least. And so I think any kind of change needs to be thought through very seriously, because most of us realize how deeply embedded aspects of our constitutional order are into our culture. And you change one of these things, you're going to change other things. So it's worth seriously thinking about before we make any kind of changes.
You worry that this will change the nature of American democracy?
Yeah, I think Electoral College really structures our federal elections. And in a lot of different ways, we have a winner-take-all system in the United States in the Electoral College. Let's start there. So most states, all except Maine and Nebraska, require you to win the entire state vote, win the popular vote in the state, in order to get all the electors in the state. Well, what impact does that have? Well, arguably, that has actually created our two-party system.
Yeah.
And so if you take it off, think about this, is we're naturally probably a four-party system, maybe five-party country, rather.
Down the middle and then those on the fringes. That makes up the four.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So think about this election right now. We have a Bernie Sanders party in this country and a Hillary Clinton party in this country, and we have a Donald Trump, wherever the heck he fits, I don't know, right now. But we have a Ted Cruz country, and maybe a Paul Ryan country, let's say. And what our two-party system sort of has the benefit of, our two-party system, is it blends those two of those together, you know, on the one side, moderates their influence, and gives us two pretty moderate two parties that we don't have to, you know, our hair doesn't have to get on fire every time we change parties.
So it keeps American politics from becoming radicalized.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Here's something you write in your book, and I wanted to ask you about. You say that this idea of reforming the system, just to this point of your concern about American politics becoming radicalized, you say this proposal to reform the electoral system is a tactic to radicalize the way we elect presidents in America. So I guess the question is, are you saying that there is, from your perspective, sort of a conscious, concerted effort to move the country to the left with this talk of trying to reform the electoral system? I mean, I've heard you talk about George Soros, for example, and I'm not saying you have a grand conspiracy here, but do you think there's a concerted effort to move the country to the left with this effort?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think there are those genuinely believe that we need to continue democratizing and that the simple answer is the right answer, and that is let everybody vote, let them all count equally. We are one nation. There's a lot of appeal to that, and I think there's a lot of people that that are drawn to that. I mean, in a lot of ways, that seems to be quintessentially American, right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you look at most of the people that are funding these operations, like George Soros' efforts, if you look at the places where it's coming from, for instance, Barbara Boxer just announced that she is going to propose a constitutional amendment. Well, it shouldn't be any surprise to us that a liberal Democrat from California is the one proposing that. It would be a surprise and more interesting, I think, if a, conservative Republican from, oh, I don't know, let's say Idaho or
Utah.
Or Wyoming. Utah. Utah would be perfect, yes.
Yeah.
In a lot of our debates, I think we need we need surprising people to pick up causes. And right now, most of those who want to abolish Electoral College are on the left, have an agenda of moving the country to the left. You know, yes, I think that's part of it for sure. It's not maybe the whole thing, but it's part of it.
You say this. You say that the once we all agree that the American founders were not anti-democratic, and there's some dispute about that. I mean, Akhil Reed Amar, who will appear on our program later after you today, doesn't in fact believe that. He doesn't think that the founders were anti-democratic. So let's just stipulate that for now, that the founders of the country didn't want to deprive the plebs of a popular vote, that they had democratic ideas. They just came about it in different ways. And you say, once we agree that that's the case, that they weren't anti-democratic, there can be a diversity here. I'm reading what you said. There can be a diversity of electoral types that are legitimate in a representative system. Explain what you mean by that, because I think most people say, well, wait, there's only one type. Give one person one vote. That's the best way of going about it. But you say, no, there are other ways. And we're a republic. Federalism is an important idea. So just give us a sort of a brief sense of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are, you know, I like to think about this by thinking about values and competing values. So I think where we go wrong in this country is very often on the left and the right is when we elevate one value above all other values and it becomes an ideology and we become blinded. I think most of the argument to abolish electoral colleges is sort of in that way. It's simple. It is democratic. Let's say one person, one vote. End of story.
Yeah.
Well, there are competing values that I think can work with being perfectly democratic, but have other values as well that you want to factor in. So, for instance, the Electoral College can be democratic, which I argue it is. Mm-hmm. We just count by the states.
Right.
Well, the other value, in Kentucky, the people of Kentucky voted, and Donald Trump was the winner in that. Popular vote and got the votes. In New York, it was Hillary that got the popular votes and got the Electoral College votes. And you in Utah for a while had a robust debate, and we were all watching you for a while to see how that would turn out, which is really cool.
Yeah.
But we also the countervailing value there is federalism. States matter. And so we can be democratic, but also then have sort of balance that with federalism. And so I think that's the way it seems to me we should look at that is let's add up all of the things that we value and let's try to figure out political systems that can give us more of those values without dropping things that we also value.
Direct democracy, then, you say, is not the only legitimate form, as long as it had what the founders described as the sense of the people. As long as it had the sense of the people, it was good. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. So if you look at the Federalist Papers, this whole way we do elections would be mind-boggling, frankly, to the founders. Yeah. The idea that we would have two champions out begging for votes, flying around the country, holding rallies, making policy proposals, cutting attack commercials. To those at the Constitutional Convention, they would be absolutely shocked by that idea. They set up a system that would a sense of the people would be involved, but it would be filtered. Mm-hmm. And this
filtered
is not how
through,
it works now.
But Professor, filtered through white men, property owners. I mean, this is the critique,
right.
Is it not?
Right.
And Hamilton believed the sense of the people was important, but I want to read something that this comes from. You cite him, and I'm guessing this is from the Federalist Papers. Hamilton saying that the sense of the people was important, but it didn't require. Here's Hamilton now, an unqualified complaisance to every sudden breeze of passion or to every transient impulse to which people may receive from the arts of men who flatter their prejudices to betray their interests, which. Let's be honest, that kind of sounds like he just doesn't trust the stupid hillbilly masses.
If you read that carefully, he's actually saying that's actually an attack on politicians. If the people are led astray by whom? By the arts of those politicians who will fool them and betray them in order to betray their interests.
Yeah, but he doesn't trust the masses to see through these wily politicians.
I think there's no way to get around that. I think that is absolutely true. Is they wanted people who had time to think about it, to had some a degree of education, that would be a trusted elite to debate, discuss, and choose a fit person, as Hamilton says in The Federalist, a fit person for president.
Right.
That's not how it works, of course, today. And it is difficult to justify according to our standards, particularly when, again, I go back to my basic argument of we need to have competing values and think about that. If our only value is democratic rule of just pure popular will at a moment, then, of course, that violates that. But so does the First Amendment. So does all the other restrictions that say to the American people, you can't have your way. You can't immediately get what you want right now. I think there's other competing things that I think the founders understood that it's complex. We got to look at a sense of the people, yes, but not we don't put it in their hands of politicians that will be demagogues and get people riled up to vote for them and then be in a position to betray them.
You write in your book that Republican government demands that our elected officials be responsible for their conduct, but not that they be immediately and robotically responsive to every turn of the public mind. But don't people have a right to vote against their interests? I mean, this is often something you hear from the left. Why are voters voting against their best interests?
Right.
They do, and they have a right to, or shouldn't they have a right to?
Absolutely, they should have a right to vote however they want to vote.
But you're suggesting we put a filter, though, in front of that the Electoral College will dampen the sort of intensity of the sort of public whim.
I'm not advocating for that.
That's what the founders wanted.
I'm talking about the founders wanted, yes. And so in their time, I'll certainly defend. That's not how it works now. But you can defend it in a sense that what the founders were, or at least explain it, what the founders wanted, this is another reason why they would just be dumbfounded by what we have seen in this election or any of our elections recently. But they wanted the elections to be about character and about electing the right person for office. And that person in office, let's say the presidency.
Yeah, virtue was a big deal for them, you say.
Virtue was a big deal for them. That's exactly right. So you pick the right people to go to Washington. It wasn't Washington, of course, at the time, but go to the Capitol and with other good people talk about the problems of the country, talk about the issues, debate them, deliberate them, take our time, and then solve problems. This whole idea, the way we run elections now, of Hillary going out with a platform and saying, I'm going to do on day one X, Y, and Z,
yeah.
and Trump going out on day and saying, in day one, I'm going to overturn these rules and I'm yeah. going to, you know, we're going to have a wall, we're going to do all this kind of thing. That's really antithetical to the founders' vision. So what they wanted was them to be responsible.
Deliberation.
So they wanted to elect the people, to elect people to office, let them deliberate, discuss, make decisions, and then let the people look at those decisions, and if they don't like them, vote them out, vote new people in. Yeah. If they do like them and they kind of work, then, you know, keep them around.
But it doesn't work that way anymore. So why do you think there's value in the Electoral College? It's not a deliberative body anymore. So why keep it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It doesn't function in any way like that. Why keep it? Because I think it is sunk deep into our political system, mm-hmm. and its tentacles go in lots of different ways that we have to spend some time untangling. So let's just start with the election right now. Now, Secretary Clinton is going to end up with, I don't know, somewhere, last time I looked at it, it was about 800,000 more votes than Donald Trump
right.
nationally.
Yeah.
Now, let's be very clear about that, though. There was never an election, there was never a campaign to win the national popular
right,
vote.
Right.
The election was fought out over 50 states. Now, it was not, you know, people in California were not doted over. That is true. The people in Pennsylvania were this time. The people in Missouri were this time. The people in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Michigan were. In other elections, it's been, well, North Carolina was true. Mm-hmm. Ohio and Florida, it always is. Let's be honest about that. But what the Electoral College gives us is that broad sort of states change over time, gives us a competitive election across the country. We had a state like Utah was competitive this year for a while, at least. In the end, it didn't seem to be, but for a while it was. If you take off the Electoral College, I think you're going to end up with a system where you have candidates, particularly Democratic candidates, but both candidates would have to do this to try to win, is you would be sunk down into L.A., New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Dallas, all the major urban hubs. And because there's enough votes to wipe out the rural votes. If you would just allow that. So, for instance, Hillary right now, if she ends up with 800,000 or so more votes, but that is also the exact number or right about the exact number that she picked up over Trump in just one city,
yeah.
And that is Los Angeles. So she won that amount. So she really sort of lost the entire country but won Los Angeles. You can think of it that way as well. Just as an example of the kind of massive numbers that could be racked up by a candidate that plops down and makes direct appeals to urban voters. And we are a diverse country, and already most of our media in this country are controlled in major cities. A huge portion of campaign contributions in this country come from the major urban areas. I looked at L.A. Numbers the other day. So L.A. Gave Secretary Clinton 1.5 million more votes and gave about $500 million in money to the campaigns. The Electoral College gives us a chance for folks out in the rest of the country to participate where they never would, I think, again. Places like West Virginia is not competitive right now, but three elections ago, it was a competitive race, and it was fought over. And
I don't get
again
that.
To be competitive.
I don't get that. Explain that to me. If you're in West Virginia or you're in Utah, how is your vote different from the person who's in Pasadena or Los Angeles? I don't understand that. If everyone's vote goes into a pool, everyone has a bean and they put it into the box, and so everyone yeah. is equal. I'm not sure. I don't get your point.
What matters is how the campaigns would change and what their priorities would be. So, for instance, the people of Utah, if you put them all in a giant pool,
yep.
think differently, look differently, act differently, have different values and political values in particular than people in, let's say, Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but there are so many mass more of those folks in Los Angeles that a Democrat was never going to risk losing some of them by making a more, let's say, more conservative appeal in Utah, because then she would drive down her vote in the major cities. They do that now because of the Electoral College. So Hillary will go out, not necessarily to Utah, but she'll go out to Western Pennsylvania and talk to hunters and talk to steel mill workers and miners. And she'll go to Iowa and try to fight for farmers. And that seems to me to leaven our political system by making candidates think about people and think about values and think about the rest of this country.
Well, we're running out of time, and I want to get to a couple of more points. I want to give you an opportunity to respond to something we'll hear from Professor Rita Marr later on the program. One of them is that the Electoral College, the way it plays out, dampens public participation. He says that the current system gives, you know, a state a fixed amount of clout in the final vote. So there's no incentive to get people to go out and vote. It doesn't really matter. However many people actually vote, you still have that fixed number of electoral votes. So there's no incentive for states and localities to get people to go out to vote. Respond to that, if you would, briefly.
Yeah, well, I think he's right on that. And again, I think there are competing values that I'm trying to lay out to compete against that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, good citizens should be driven to the polls because they've got Senate races, because they've got congressional races,
right,
because they've got local races. You know, and so I think this is a problem for another show, is how much influence we have centered in the American presidency and how much of we value the American presidency to the detriment of the rest of our political system.
A big point that Professor Rita Marr makes is that the Electoral College was created to essentially give an advantage to the slaveholding South, that it was part of the Three-Fifths Compromise. And in that sense, it's a very tainted system. Would you respond to that briefly?
Well, so is Congress. So does he want to throw out Congress? You know, a lot of people don't like Congress. That's where it comes from. It's not part of the Electoral College. The Electoral College just built its representation system on the system set up for Congress. And that is, we have two senators from every state. They all count equally, no matter what your population is. So I don't know how you have it both ways on that. And I think, frankly, it's a red herring to throw up slavery in the, because it doesn't, none of my arguments are about what the founders intended, as you can tell here.
Yeah.
It's all about, let's look out how it functions now. And does it function as a general rule to give us a broad representation across this country? Does it function to keep us from having massive, frightening recounts during very close elections? Think about the 2000 race.
Yeah. You worry about logistics, don't you?
Logistics of the vote count?
Yeah, pulling it off. You've talked about the nightmare of precincts around the country.
Yeah,
having recounts. Yeah, you do worry about that. It seems.
Well, think of the first night. Now, Secretary Clinton is opening up a big lead now, but think about the first night where we thought it was about 150,000. First couple of days, 150,000 votes different between Trump and Clinton. Well, there are 187,000 precincts in this country.
Right.
So, and you had a candidate that said that the system was rigged. So do you think in a scenario like that, if we didn't have the Electoral College, we might be recounting in every precinct, in every, not only recounting, but trying to change votes? Remember the Florida count of the hanging chads, trying to decipher what this candidate may have meant, or this voter may have meant by their action. I think it would really be a nightmare and would really become very divisive in this country.
You don't think those who want to reform the electoral process, you've said in the past anyway, at least had any momentum before. Now, there's this National Popular Vote Interstate Compact that some say is making some progress. You seem doubtful about this. This National Compact has been adopted by 10 states. I think they have something like 160, and we'll go through this later, the electoral votes. But what do you think? You've said you don't think there's a sustained effort. Do you think that the latest situation with Hillary Clinton getting more popular votes than Donald Trump is going to change the momentum? What do you think finally about that?
I think there's actually a little more momentum right now than there was in 2000, partly because of Trump. Mm-hmm. He's a little more frightening to some people than George W. Bush was, but also because it's happened twice now in 16 years, where it took us 100 plus to do it before. So, right. So there's a little bit. But if, again, you look at all of those states doing the compact thing, it is they're all Democratic states. They're all deep blue states. And so you're not going to get the representatives from Utah, the representatives from Kentucky, mm-hmm. representatives from the rest out here in the Midwest to agree to that, a system that they know when they think about it is going to strip all of their power away and their influence in the executive branch, maybe forever. And so that's not going to happen, I don't think.
Final question, about a minute left. In the book that you wrote about the Electoral College, the book that you edited, you worried about the aftermath of the election in 2000 when Senator Gore won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College. You said there might be a bitter national battle. That didn't come to pass. Do you think that's coming, a bitter national battle over this?
I think it is. There's a real potential right now. There's much more interest than there was after 2000, it seems to me. But on the other hand, I think knowing what happened in 2000, if we remember that, that's what pulled a lot of the sting out of this, because people saw the potential of that national nightmare and were actually pretty thankful when they thought about it that we were centering our battle in Florida and not battling across the entire country.
It's Gary L. Gregg. He's a presidential scholar, director of the McConnell Center for Political Leadership at the University of Louisville. Joined us earlier today from a studio at the NPR affiliate station WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Electoral College, because maybe you've heard every once in a while one presidential candidate becomes president and yet receives fewer actual votes. So we're talking about why we have an Electoral College, how it fits or doesn't into our concept of democracy. We're also asking, why not just have one person, one vote, and leave it at that? We heard from Gary L. Gregg earlier on the program. Joining us now is Akhil Reed Amar, who is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He's the author of a number of acclaimed books on the Constitution. He has his latest is The Constitution Today, Timeless Lessons for the Issues of Our Era. He's joining us from a studio on the campus of Yale University today. And Professor Akhil Reed Amar, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I want to begin with something you've written, is that you've always had your doubts about the Electoral College, even when you were pretty young.
Yeah. I grew up in California, and it at first seemed just odd, given that equality was an idea very much in the air in California, that the Electoral College didn't quite seem equal. People in different places, their votes seemed to count somewhat differently. I was encouraged not just by bumper stickers, but by my teachers, my scoutmasters, to ask questions about authority. Just why do we have this? Is there a better system? It was a time when the Constitution was actually the 1960s and 70s amended in some other respects. Change was in the air. So I just, as a kid, started thinking about it.
You say that over time you have, here's how you put it, refined your disdain for the Electoral College. Explain what you mean and where you've sort of ended up in your thinking about it.
Well, there are some arguments for it, yeah. and we've already heard some. So I don't think it's an open and shut case. One thing, for example, that I am not challenging immediately is, for example, the Senate.
Yeah.
And the Senate counts different states in some ways unequally, in that a big state like California with 70 times as many people as a small state like Wyoming has the same number of seats in the Senate. So if I don't like the Electoral College, does that mean that I have to oppose the Senate as well? I actually don't think so. I think there's some differences. Yeah. It is complicated.
I wanted to have you respond to what we heard from Professor Gregg earlier about this idea of the nature of our democracy. It is designed to be, you know, this republic, and the way the framers thought about an electoral college, and we'll get to your sense of the origins of all of this here in a moment, but to that general idea that this is a matter of federalism, there are alternative ways besides just direct democracy to come at it, and this is one way, and if you change it, it could have an effect on that.
All true. I don't think there's a huge difference between democracies and republics. They're very similar etymologically, and in fact, the party that calls itself the Democratic Party today was co-founded by Jefferson and Madison. They called themselves the Democrats, the Republicans, the Republican Democrats. So I don't think actually, apart from a couple of Federalist Papers, that people at the time sharply distinguished between democracies and republics. They did say that democracies could be direct or indirect, and indirect sometimes is better. It's why we don't vote on everything by referendum, for example. Federalism is important. By the way, direct election of the president would involve the states, would involve federalism in some really nifty ways, because states could actually improvise and compete against each other in ways that would, for example, each state would have an incentive to encourage folks to get out and vote. And one state might say, we'll make Election Day a holiday. Another state will say, we'll have same-day registration. Another state will say, we'll have early voting. It would be federalism at its best, state laboratories of experimentation trying to improve democracy. So I'm for federalism, and I'm also aware that if you change the system, there could be unintended consequences. And one of the best reasons to keep the system is just sort of inertia. It works well enough, and there might be unintended consequences of any reform.
But you think we should change it, or do you?
I do. I'm a believer in the very American, very profound idea of one person, one vote. Mm-hmm. And several of the arguments, with due respect, that I think Dr. Gregg put forth prove too much. They're not right. They're, in some deep sense, un-American. Okay, you talk about Los Angeles and 800,000. Well, that's true when you're picking – I'm from California, the governor of California too.
Yeah.
And there are rural parts of California. I live in the countryside, and I've always grown up in the countryside. And Shasta County is a little Utah in California. But here's what we don't do in California. We don't have an electoral college to pick our governor, whether that governor is Ronald Reagan or Jerry Brown. Mm. Call us crazy, but here's what we do in California. We count up all the votes equally. One person, one vote. And if it's close, we recount them carefully. Call us crazy, but that's how we do it in Texas. And that's how we roll in Pennsylvania and in Connecticut and even in Utah. Indeed, in every single state, we have a little mini president. We call him or her a governor, typically 4-year term, veto pen, pardon pen. And we do not pick that mini president by a mini electoral college in order to you know, keep the cities in their place and to boost rural areas. So that argument for the electoral college, with due respect, is a bad one. It's an un-American one. There are arguments for the electoral college. Yeah. I've already given you a couple.
Yeah.
Federalism is complicated. Maybe the United States is different from a single state, and a county like Shasta County is different than a state like Utah. There are some differences, but I don't buy the rural versus urban. I don't buy the recount argument. Oh, it would be a nightmare. Well, we managed to do it in California and Texas and every other place. And by the way, the recount nightmare that we had in 2000 was in states, and not just Florida, but actually the New Hampshire and New Mexico. All three required very careful recounting, and yet it was clear that nationally, Al Gore had 500,000 more votes. So it's possible that when you have direct election, you'd have to do a broader recount. It's also true that under the existing system, often you have horrible, nightmarish recounts, even in state by state, multiple states, even though there wouldn't be a need for a national recount because the national vote winner is clear. So I don't think the recount argument is a good one. I don't think the rural argument is a good one. I do think there are good arguments for the status quo.
What do you make of his contention that the Electoral College essentially makes the two political parties, essentially, in this country?
Oh, yeah, good.
Come to the center. Do you think
yes, because and listen, I just made a deep point saying we have 50 mini presidents called governors.
Yeah.
We have a two-party system for governor in every state, and we don't have an electoral college. We have a two-party system for every senator, U.S. senator, or for every member of the House of Representatives, and for every state senator and state representative. You have a two-party system for reasons having nothing to do with the electoral college. I wrote a book in 2012. It's called America's Unwritten Constitution. There's a whole chapter on the two-party system. I'm a believer in it. Mm-hmm. It's a deep American concept, but the electoral college doesn't solidify it. And you in Utah, of all places, should know that because it's because of the Electoral College that we had a third candidate named McMullen whom we wouldn't have had in a direct national election system because, with all due respect, none of the rest of us outside Utah, you know, paid much attention to the fellow. So there are arguments for the Electoral College, but a two-party system is not a good one. The rural argument is not a good one. The recount argument is not a good one. And when you pay attention to federalism, which involves looking at, for example, how states pick governors, you see all three of the points I just made.
Yeah. I want to get your sense of the origins of all of this, because how the slaveholding states, the sort of dissent between the North and the South, I think are a really important part of the context for all of this. Before we get there, I wanted to get you to respond. What are you hearing from opponents of changing the Electoral College? I mean, you hear from Professor Gregg this idea that there's this concerted effort to kind of radicalize the country, to move it to the left. What do you make of that? Because you hear that from time to time.
Well, perhaps I'm not part of that. My views about the Electoral College, as you actually reminded your readers of, go back 40 years, 50 years even. I'm don't believe in radicalism, truthfully. The best argument for the Electoral College is just a straight up Burkean traditional conservative argument of inertia. It's the system we have, and that's not a bad argument. In fact, I think it's maybe one of the best arguments. But see, if you think the problem is the recount, then you think actually the logic of that position is every state should have a little mini electoral college to pick its governor, and we don't. Yeah. Other countries should have an electoral college. That would be the implication of the recount is a problem, or the rural thing is a problem, or the two-party thing. So getting the right argument is important for thinking about other parts of the system. I don't believe in radicalism for its own sake. I actually, in doing this interview, delayed a train trip. I'm taking a train trip down to the Federalist Society National Convention later today. I missed earlier today in order to be on your show. Clarence Thomas, my friend, and Sam Alito, although I'm going to do a double event with Sam Alito in New York City Friday and Saturday. So maybe there are folks out there that have all sorts of kooky radical ideas and electoral college reform form is part of a radical agenda. That's at least not where I am coming from.
And we're grateful. Thanks very much for making us a priority. We appreciate
it. Anytime for Utah, anytime for NPR. I mentioned my scoutmaster who encouraged me to think deep thoughts as a kid. His family, he's LDS. He's from Utah. He actually took me to Salt Lake City the very first time. It made a very big impression on me. So anything for the good people of Utah and for NPR.
Great. Well, thanks. Another point that I mentioned to Professor Gregg is that there are scholars who believe that the founders of the country, the framers, were in many ways anti-democratic. You don't actually necessarily think
right. I push
like
back
that.
On that. Yeah. You already heard a little pushback when I said there's not a sharp distinction between democracies and republics. They're pretty much the same thing. The man who writes the words, "We the people," his name is James Wilson. Mm-hmm. He's one of the first six justices on the Supreme Court appointed by George Washington, the greatest lawyer in America, the founder of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, And he says the democratic principle is carried into every part of the Constitution, and he says that proudly. They put the Constitution to a vote. We, the people, did, in fact, ordain and establish this Constitution up and down a continent, that something that had never before happened in world history before the American Revolution. The Declaration of Independence wasn't put to a vote. The Articles of Confederation wasn't put to a vote. None of the state constitutions in 1776 was put to a vote. A couple of states did put their constitutions to a vote between 1776 and the Philadelphia Convention, Massachusetts and New Hampshire. But putting the Constitution to a vote was an amazing moment in world history, world transformative, and a profoundly democratic moment. In that election, in 8 of the 13 states that actually ratified the Constitution, property qualifications that ordinarily applied in ordinary elections were lowered or eliminated in this special jubilee year, we the people do ordain and establish moment. They created a House of Representatives that ordinary people could vote for, which you didn't have under the Articles Confederation. There are no property qualifications to be a member of the House or the Senate or the President. The Constitution for its time was really a remarkably and proudly and self-consciously democratic achievement in world history.
You mentioned James Wilson of Pennsylvania.
Yes.
He's important in the and he's important in the story because it's interesting, he proposes at first
A direct election.
Yeah, a direct election of the president. And then he gets pushback from, I think, James Madison of Virginia. So what? The Electoral College is kind of a compromise.
So he says he's an amazing guy. There are folks who say, oh, you can't trust the states and the new states to come in the interior. We should always have a majority for the coastal people.
Yeah.
And so that would be that would not be fair to Utah, the Utahs of the world.
Yeah.
And James Wilson said, no, that's not right. James Wilson believes in proportional representation. He actually believes one person, one vote. He even believes women should have the vote.
Yeah.
He's like ahead of his time in all sorts of ways. So he says, in principle, we should put this choice to the people. James Madison actually says, in principle, you are right.
Yeah.
But I, James Madison, have just done the math on the back of this envelope, so to speak, and I've realized if we do that, the South will lose every time. I, James Madison, come from the South because a huge proportion of our population are slaves and they won't vote. So direct election will get outvoted every time. So it's in that conversation and your audience can actually, if they just go online and Google my name, can find hyperlinks to James Madison's notes recording this conversation, you see how the Electoral College has connections to slavery. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep it today. I agree with Dr. Gregg that there may be reasons today that are different from the founding. Slavery, though, plays an even bigger role slightly later in our story when Jefferson runs against Adams for president twice.
I want to come to that but before we move along, let's just mention that part of the deal is that the southern states then could count their slaves as 3/5.
Exactly. Electoral college, instead of direct election, slaves don't vote. So Virginia loses, say, to Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has more voters in 1800, more free people than Virginia in 1800. But with an electoral college, Virginia has more electoral votes because it gets to count its slave population, admittedly at a discount, 3/5 rather than 5/5.
Right.
But that's going to mean Virginia gets more electoral votes than Pennsylvania in 1800, even though Pennsylvania has more voters and more free people. And it's not a surprise then, you see, that for 8 of the first 9 presidential elections, the winner is, you know, surprise, surprise, a Virginian.
Yeah.
Washington twice, Jefferson twice, Madison twice, Monroe twice.
Did I get this right? I wrote this down. For 32 of the first 36 years, a white slaveholding Virginian occupied the presidency?
Yes, and the only 4 years that they didn't, it's John Adams. Massachusetts is the second or third biggest state, depending on how you count. Maine was at that point part of Massachusetts. And then you have John Quincy Adams. Yeah, 32 years is 8 presidential terms, 2 terms apiece for Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, the Virginia plantation slaveocracy.
So this wasn't about concerns about big states, little states. It was concerns about slaveholding. It was the North and the South.
That's right. And by the way, I want to take back a little bit slaveocracy just because it has an edge to it, and I don't mean to have an edge to it. I revere George Washington in particular, and one of the things I so admire about him is he understood by the end that slavery was wrong. He didn't create the system. He inherited it, but he actually took steps to try to actually get us away from that system. He provided on his deathbed for freeing of slaves, and I'm actually more critical of Jefferson and Madison because they didn't follow Washington's lead, but Washington actually tried to set an anti-slavery example by the end of his life.
You know, you've often heard this contention that the framers created the electoral system at first as a kind of a system that was designed to fail, is how it's been put, that these early leaders wanted to get Washington elected, basically. And then they figured after that it didn't really matter. The Electoral College would always be deadlocked, so you'd have the selection of the president in the House of Representatives. And that's how they intended it. What do you think about that?
There are those who say that. They quote a man named George Mason who says that 19 out of 20 times it's going to be resolved in the House of Representatives. Yeah. In my 2005 book, I suggest that that's what George Mason thought. That's not what a lot of others thought. Right. James Wilson expressly said, I disagree with that. And my money's on Wilson because he actually turned out to have been right and Mason turned out to have been wrong, because once you have two parties in place, as emerged very soon after Washington passes from the political scene, each of the two parties is going to nominate someone and the race is going to narrow down to two people, and that's going to generate basically typically a majority in the first round, and you never need to get to deadlocks in Congress and complicated three-way votes and all of that stuff.
It seems like that this is a theme in all of this, that Americans at first, yeah, there was resistance to the idea of a populist presidency, but you say in your book that Americans began to embrace this system where you have national campaigns, where you have sort of a mandate of the people, that we kind of matured into this? Is that
right? Very early on, we had one president above party. His name is George Washington. Every single elector voted for him twice, but he stands almost literally head and shoulders above everyone else. He's the indispensable man. But when he passes from the scene, very quickly, you have two parties, and two parties aren't, again, created by the Electoral College. They're true in governors' races, and there's no Electoral College at the state level. A two-party system is going to naturally be the product when you have one office, a big office up for grabs, whether it's a senator or a governor or president. When you have one office up for grabs in the musical chairs game, you're going to have two parties vying for that one office, and that emerges very early on. It's Jefferson against Adams. Mm-hmm. And that debate, once Washington has passed from the scene, is not big state versus small state. It's basically the South against the North. Jefferson's a Southerner. He wins the South both times. Yeah. Adams is a Northerner. He wins the North both times. The election is decided where North meets South. Today, that's Ohio or Virginia. Back then, it was called New York, which was a slave state. New York, the first time around, votes with Adams, the Northerner. The second time, it votes for Jefferson, the Southerner, who allies with a guy named Aaron Burr from New York. But here's what the Northerners notice as a result of these two North-South elections. Jefferson is getting extra votes in the Electoral College because of slavery, because of the Three-Fifths Clause. If you take away the extra electoral votes that all the Southern states are enjoying and they're voting for Jefferson, the Virginias, the South Carolinas, the Georgias, the North Carolinas, if you take away the extra electoral votes that they have just simply because they have lots of slaves, the Northerners realize, hey, we would have won in 1800 too. There are 13 extra electoral votes that Thomas Jefferson is getting because of slavery. In the phrase of the newspapers at the time, the anti-Jefferson newspapers, Mr. Jefferson is riding into the executive mansion on the backs of his slaves. Mm-hmm. That's a thesis put forth by the great scholar Gary Wills, a great originally conservative scholar, one of Bill Buckley's proteges at the National Review. And that's the thesis that Gary Wills puts forth very powerfully in a book that your audience might find interesting called Negro President. It's a book all about Thomas Jefferson. He was referred to dismissively, mockingly, as the Negro President because actually slaves and three-fifths were the margin of victory. And what happened afterward? We amended the Constitution.
Yeah, this is the 12th Amendment.
Yeah, the Electoral College. The Electoral College that we have is not something that was hammered out at Philadelphia, but something that was revised and reinvented after Jefferson, Adams, Burr in 1800. It's the 12th Amendment in which you now vote for a team, president and vice president as a ticket. And that's the Electoral College we have, and that Electoral College system was very much crafted fully aware of the slavery skew.
And that's the one we have today. That's the one
that's the one we have today.
About. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not actually what they came up with at Philadelphia, because at Philadelphia, if you come in second for the presidency, you're vice president. That doesn't make sense when two parties emerge, because do you really want a person – if you have, you know, Jefferson and Adams going after each other, hammer and tong, the way Clinton and Trump did, do you really want the loser of that, the person who comes in second for the presidency, to be the vice president? That's like an assassination incentive. That's just trouble from the beginning. So we revised the system once two parties emerged.
Let's talk about this workaround you and a few others have sort of figured out. Something that's legal, something that's fair, rather than go through the laborious, complicated process of amending the Constitution. What you figured out a while back is you don't really have to do that. You can find a legal statutory process to get to a direct, to a one-person, one vote. This is the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Talk about this, if you would.
Yeah. Each state today gets to decide, its legislature gets to decide how to allocate its electoral votes. Most states say you have to win. We're going to let people in our state vote. And in fact, that happened very early on, almost from the beginning. The electors basically were potted plants. The voters, state by state, were pretty much deciding from a very, very early point in our history. But today, every state, by the time of the Civil War, only South Carolina isn't letting you do that. But today, every state lets you do that. Now, in every state except Maine and Nebraska, the legislature says whoever wins the popular vote in our state gets all of our electoral votes, winner take all. Maine and Nebraska say winner takes most, maybe not all. We might have a little apportionment system. Mm-hmm. Okay. But here's what a legislature is allowed to do if it wanted. In theory, the legislature could say we're going to pick the electors. No one does that today, but in theory they have that right. But here's what they also can do. They can say in the next presidential election in 2020 or 2024, we're going to give our electoral votes from our state to the person who wins the national popular vote if enough other states agree to do the same. And if enough states kind of agree to do this, and if they add up to 270 electoral votes, and if they all agree that whoever wins the national popular vote is going to get the electoral vote from those states, well, 270 is all you need. Yeah. And then, in effect, you'd have a national vote system.
Professor Gregg says, and we're running out of time, but I just want to get this in. Professor Gregg says, look, you're going to have all the purple states, all the blue states may be interested, but Republicans aren't going to want that. But what do you say to that? Why wouldn't Republicans want a direct vote?
He may be right. I personally don't think the Electoral College today is strongly skewed in favor of one party or the other. Yeah, it disfavored Al Gore in 2000, but the day before the election, lots of us thought he might actually win. And this, lots of us, include George W. Bush, thought that Gore might win the Electoral College vote while losing the popular vote. Right. And in 2004, John Kerry lost the national vote by 3 million, I think. But if he'd gotten 50,000 more votes in Ohio, he would have won the presidency. Suppose he'd been an Ohio senator rather than a Massachusetts senator. So today, I actually don't think the Electoral College is strongly skewed. Yeah, it hurt Clinton. Yeah, it hurt Gore. But I actually don't think it's strongly skewed. But many Republicans might believe, hey, the system helped us this year. It helped us in 2000. Why mess with it? And so they might believe, perhaps wrongly, that the system is currently is slightly structured in their favor. I'm not sure that that's so. It might be so. Yeah. I'm not doing it for partisan reasons.
Do you think there's momentum? We're essentially out of time, but do you think there's momentum to get this going again?
Well, and the momentum may fade because there's going to be a story next week and the week after that.
So, true.
So I'm not holding my breath. There is another way to get to direct election, different from the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. I'm going to be writing up a little bit more about that in the next several weeks, so stay tuned. I've got another harebrained idea about how we might improvise our way toward direct election. And when I say, you know, I'm mocking myself, saying harebrained idea, but your readers, your audience might be interested that even before there was direct election of senators formally, states improvised all sorts of ways to informally get direct election of senators, beginning with the Lincoln-Douglas debates and other things. So there are precedents for other parts of our constitutional system where we had some informal adaptations before we had formal amendments. I'll give you one final one. A two-term tradition is at first an informal idea. George Washington steps down after two terms, and then Jefferson and Madison and Monroe follow suit. And for a long time, it's sort of an informal adaptation, and only later does it become a formal constitutional rule that a president can't serve more than two terms. So our constitutional system has a lot of suppleness to it. Primaries weren't important before Jack Kennedy. Oh, no one talked about Iowa before Jimmy Carter. Barack Obama, you know, discovers the internet. Donald Trump has shown us the power of Twitter. We've had, even though the formal rules have stayed the same in some ways, our system of how we actually elect presidents has changed dramatically in our lifetime, several times.
Akhil Reed Amar, professor of law and political science at Yale University. His new book, which you should check out, is called The Constitution Today, Timeless Lessons for the Issues of Our Era. Professor, thanks very much for taking the time. We're grateful.
Always for NPR, always for Utah.
Thanks a lot. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.